Ray Middleton, reel 5.
So it was your injuries that actually enabled you to see a slightly more relaxed side to the war.
That's right, because coming back meant I left the battalion behind, but I travelled by train with a lot of other Australians from all the units. We were on a stretcher train from Alexandria to El Cantara, where the Australian hospital was, and we were greatly relieved to leave the bombs behind. And we had then batches of us on stretchers in the train that then cruised through until we got to the canal where we were taken across. They wanted to know, do we need to go by stretcher or whatever? And we were very relieved to get to an Australian hospital. So you tended to lose so much the unit identity, but keep the Australian. So we had all sorts of units and all sorts of stories. Most of them were, you know, what have you got? I've got this or that. I had eye injury, and I found within a few days of arriving at El Cantara that one thing I didn't have was any eye specialists. So they had healed up most of the other wounds by then, or the other damage, and they said, well, we better send you off to the eye hospital, and that's in Cairo. They said, can you walk? I said, with the stick, I think I can. So they gave me a rail warrant and put me on the train to Cairo and told me to report to the 15th Scottish Hospital. It turned out to be what had been built as a women's hospital outside Cairo. I don't know where it is now. And had been commandeered and made into a Scottish hospital run by the Navy, of all things, and all naval staff to a naval discipline. And so they kept naval hours and the naval bugle calls. And you were summoned, Reveille was an Navy call, and they had the meals which are specified by Navy. So you had tea at 4 p.m. and sup at 7. In midsummer Cairo was not appropriate when they came up with kai, you know, the thick and cocoa which you have at sea. That's their idea of tea at 4 p.m. That plus a tiny little bun of some sort, or pie, palet, that consisted of tea. The meals were what you might expect, somewhat poor. And I think I was the only Australian in the ward. There were 40-odd, all with eye injuries, most with shrapnel. And only two of us didn't lose an eye. One, Tommy and myself, we both refused to let him take it out, and we even knew his procedure. The so-called eye specialists were learning by doing, two of them, and they used to... they had a routine which we watched and we saw in operation. They'd come around and the little Scotch doctor, that's a very bad eye you've got. Shook his head and passed on. Next day, that's a very, very bad eye. On the third day, yeah, trouble is if you keep that very bad eye, it'll affect the other one. And the fourth day, you'd be whipped quietly into a room. Half an hour later, you're back with one eye. So, of course, each incoming bod then, we used to say, now, what colour eye have you got? Gee, he hasn't got that in his collection. We'd give him the routine that would come, and we're generally right. But the Tommy alongside me, he'd been a tank driver in the 7th Armoured Div, and he had a 75mm shell had hit the front of his tank and blown the glass into his face. So they patched up most of his face, but of course he was only able to see a shadow. So they said, you've detached the retina. When you've rested enough, we'll use an electric needle to sew the retina back on the eye. They took the eye out of the socket and sewed it on and then put it back, was the technique. Anyway, he and I were good mates, and both of us refused utterly to let him take it out. Simple as that. And that was why we got out with Ives. And I had to attend to him for 5 or 6 weeks while he was flat on his back. He couldn't lift his head in case he detached the retina. In fact, it did happen no matter what. And he went to St. Dunstan's in England and was discharged. But we got good mates and remained in communication. And as late as 1980, I think, we had some letters. I've lost touch now. But that was where I sort of saw a different side, saw Tommy's view of the war. And an Aussie was a rarity. And I was in that hospital when my next elder brother, Alan, came over with the Air Force, and he was full of enthusiastic as a pilot officer doing his final training, conversion course. And then they were sent to the CO of the hospital to tell me that he'd been killed in a training accident. I was just about due for discharge. They put me into an operation which you're perfectly awake all the time. They merely did a local anaesthetic, and they argued about whether to make a lateral cut, a vertical cut, or and so on, and when they couldn't decide, they made a diagonal. And anyway, they couldn't get the shrapnel out, so after they'd argued and so on, they said, oh, well, let's forget it. So they sewed it up or whatever and put a patch over it. And after that had healed, they said, we can't do anything more. I said, well, what's happened? He said, well, it can't be steel. I said, so what? Or it must be aluminium. So if it's aluminium, we think it will dissolve and become part of your system and shouldn't affect it. And if it's steel, well, it'll rust and you lose the eye. Oh, thank you. He said, you should have some sight for quite a while. So they discharged me then. I was just about due for it. And I got permission to go and find my brother's grave.
How did you take the news of your brother's death?
I was very upset. I had to write. I was in touch with the family by letter, of course. And my mother tried to get me home on compassionate grounds, but I couldn't justify it, and I wouldn't consider it. And we knew that there was a risk anyway, so I went and managed to find my way to where he was buried.
Do you think people, troops and that sort of thing, people such as yourselves, were hardened to the tragedy of war?
Oh, yes. I hadn't thought about it until my brother brought in one of his other officers and he saw the black patch. He said, you lost your eye. I said, oh, no, it's only a piece of shrapnel. And he thought it was terribly funny that I said, only a piece of shrapnel. He said, well, when you see most of them with an eye missing, it's nothing much to worry about. It's all a matter of point of view. One chap was building a railway in Egypt and he'd fallen into the Sweetwater Canal. That was enough to poison him and he lost an eye as a result. That's how foul the waters were in the canals of Egypt.
What about the general troops' feelings towards religion and God and things like that? Were they altered?
Not much, no. We had a padre in the hospital, a Tommy Padre, who was very good. I know because he had about 7 of the old Charlie Chaplin whatever silent films. And when we were allowed to go and watch those. And it was marvellous. I saw all of the Mack Sennett and all the early films, and he had them on the original screen. And that was his way of helping us. And we didn't have any church services that I recall. One thing I recall is a French woman, utterly patriotic, coming in with her squeeze box, singing La Marseillaise and Jacques André and various other French songs right in our faces to the stage that we all backed away in. I think we were just plain embarrassed. We didn't have any bother there. The Tommies, of course, were mostly concerned with news from home. Well, I was there in that hospital. I remember seeing the local headline in the local paper, September the 15th, so many 186, I think they said, German planes shot down. We lost 20 and something, some whatever figure. I'm sure it was wrong, but beside the point, it was a morale boosting. The battle for Britain was at its peak, and we had won, that sort of thing.
Was that one of the differences between the Tommies and yourselves, that you didn't have your families at risk at home?
At that point, no. We did. At that point, it was before the Pacific War had started. That, of course, was different when the second one, we got to Alamein, that was utterly different. But during the Tobruk part of it, we were the only Australians in action, and we were then much featured in Australian news. Again, the area, apart from Greece, Crete and North Africa, where else were Australians involved? There were planes, and there were people being shot down there. There were a few sea battles, but they were mostly remote.
Was it important for you to know that your family was safe at home?
I took it for granted at that point. Until Pearl Harbor, we didn't expect any trouble after that time.
How important was it for you to receive mail from home?
Very important. Mail was always, mail day was critical, no matter where it was your contact. And did a lot of letter writing. It was one of the few ways to ease boredom. And I wrote to a lot of people. Apart, I even wrote to the old boss in the office, you know, but just the occasional letter, short note or card. And people I knew in the office, and I had, at that stage I was unattached, so I had, I think, 7 girls I was writing to at the time. But, you know, you and try to keep in mind now, I took her out, did she know the other one? Better not talk about that in case. That sort of communication.
What were some of the things that you found out about home?
I remember my mother writing and saying that she was busy making, working with rope, making camouflage. What on earth? And I asked, what did you mean? She said, I suppose the stencil will allow camouflage nets. And I said, oh, yeah. But I hadn't realised they were even doing that. We had no mention of rationing, excepting that I remember my brother, who was with Good Tarrant Murray, said that just before enlisted, he said, buy yourself 2 pairs of shoes. They're going to be short. I said, are they? He said, yes. So I bought a pair of dancing shoes, and because I was keen on dancing, and a pair of heavy brogues, I suppose. And they were left in their box because I knew they'd be short when I came home. But he told me they're going to be rationed. I couldn't believe it, but he was in the state place to know. He was 2IC of the head of the warehouse supplying shoes.
Was home somewhere that featured in your thoughts a lot?
Oh, yes, news of home, and they couldn't talk about much what so-and-so was doing, and couldn't get a great deal. Tell you about your pet cat or whatever, you know, that sort of thing. They couldn't say very much about other members who were in the forces. I remember a lass writing from the office saying that one of the persons I've been working with, sorry about him. He said, but I don't suppose you want to hear bad news. And I had no idea he'd been shot down the Air Force, but that was the sort of item that you heard. At that point, no. Later on, things were very different. But this was stage one of the war. Stage two was a year later when Japan was in it. And attitudes had changed considerably over that time.
What was your next major involvement in battle?
From Lebanon in Syria, it was treated as the one then, we were expecting to go home because Pearl Harbor had occurred. 6th Division had been sent home, 7th Division had been sent home, we were waiting to go home. And we heard of the fall of Singapore, And we heard then, we were in, still of course in Syria, and we knew things were tough, and we even heard news of the bombing of Broome. That really worried us, it was getting close. And let's get home and beat those bloody Japs, was the general thought. And we thought we were headed for it. Instead of which, of course, the generals were overturned, if you like. Churchill forced the issue. We must save the canal. We need the 9th Division.
You were in Syria, you were saying.
That's right.
What were you doing there?
We were garrisoning Syria against a projected or possible advance through Turkey. If the Germans had reached the Caucasus, they could have gone down through Turkey, and they thought that Turkey might change if they were invaded, but in any case, we were sending supply trainloads of gear for the Turks to help defend themselves, to keep on the good side. And we were taking trainloads up, I was escorting one of them, which we were leaving then up on the border, and in the morning the train would come back empty. So we were definitely supplying the Turks to try and keep sweet with them. And to cover as an insurance policy, the 7th Div had started, and we continued building defence lines across in case they came down through Syria. But we were there then as a garrison, as we saw it. It had been conquered already by the 7th Division, taken from Vichy France, and the people were quite happy about that. But then, of course, instead of going home, as we were directed to North Africa.
What was that time like before you were sent to?
It was a holiday time other than the worries about home. Dear John, letters kept coming from girls who said, I can't have people having holidays in Syria when Australia's in danger, so I'm now going out with a real soldier who's going to fight for Australia. And this didn't make for a lot of happiness. There were quite a few Dear John letters arrived in that time. I didn't get any myself, but then I wasn't engaged to any, which helped. And we fully expected to go home, instead of which, of course, we didn't. So we were, our gear was stripped out. When I say our gear, anything that identified us as Australian, felt hats, badges and so on, and our divisional insignia was painted out of trucks, and we were sent down via the inland road down beside Lake Tiberias and down through Palestine, and it looked as though we were heading for the ship, instead of which we turned and went across the desert to Alexandria.
Now, you weren't told where you were going. Why?
Well, the enemy has ears, was always the way. Don't tell the troops and they can't tell anybody else. Only tell a few top officers.
What was the situation at that time?
The British had fallen back to El Alamein, and heavy fighting was taking place at El Alamein. And that was the last line of defence before the fall of Cairo, which would have meant the loss of the canal and the loss of all the oil. It was the oil that was the lifeblood that they were concerned with. Egypt was a means of maintaining the oil lifeline as well as connection through the canal.
What sort of strength were the Germans at this stage?
I think they had a limited number, only about 3 German divisions, but at least 4 Italian divisions. He used Germans to stiffen every division of Italians. And this was a pattern that Rommel worked out that he found necessary. So although theoretically an Italian marshal was senior to Rommel as a general, it always worked out that Rommel was in charge no matter what. And he sent a batch of Germans whenever he thought that the Italians might crumble.
And what were the attitudes towards Rommel at this stage?
He was given a considerable respect, so much so that Montgomery took it on himself. He said, I've got to build up the morale by seeing the troops see us as good as Rommel. Otherwise, we're boosting the Africa Corps, which gives them a big psychological boost in a battle. We knew that they had better tanks. We knew that they had better guns. We'd already experienced some of those. And the last thing we need is to think of them as supermen because of it. They had a few good ideas. For example, their jerry cans we copied. We had 4-gallon square cans of petrol, of which we lost some terrific percentage before they ever reached the front lines because they were flimsy. They carried 2 4-gallon cans per kerosene case of petrol was their means of transport. Very flimsy, most unsatisfactory. The Germans carried in bulk, transferred it into the so-called jerry cans still in use here, and they pioneered it, putting them on the back of tanks with that, which is obviously much better than 4-gallon flimsy containers. And then they had managed to get their, they had their Kubel wagons based on the Volkswagen, which didn't require water. They had no radiators. And this was a big plus in the desert. So VW had something suited the desert. We were still using water-using, heavy water-using American-made trucks. When we were practicing while we were in Syria, we'd had a desert training effort with new Ford trucks straight from USA. And they had to use our urine to maintain the water level in the totally inadequate radiators, because we couldn't afford water. And of course they knew that the life of the radiator was going to be limited using urine, but you weren't going to use drinking water. So that was the sort of thing where they designed it with small radiators and small capacity for North America, and they sent them to the Middle East. British tanks the same way, they weren't designed for the desert. The guns were designed years before, and they hadn't got round to increasing the size until the 6-pounder anti-tank guns, which was not until mid-42. We didn't get any decent anti-tank guns until then. 2-pounders that replaced the 47mm Breeders were slightly better in that they fitted British ammunition. We weren't dependent on the enemy. But they still only had a very short range, and they still wouldn't penetrate a heavy German tank unless you got it on the vulnerable rear or something. So we were at a great disadvantage weapon wise even when after we were captured.
When you found out that you were going to El Alamein, how did you feel?
Well, somebody's got to stop the bastards, and we can prove we've done it before, we can do it again. The way we saw it, they're in desperate straits. If they've got a call on the Australians, all right, we'll show them. So that's the way we saw it. Let's clean them up and stop that, and then we can go home.
Tell us about that.
Well, we were... The 9th Division was required to go up and fill the line at Alamein, which was a narrow enough front to be maintained. Luckily, we did have quite a few hundreds of guns. The artillery was intact. So we had a lot of artillery, and they pulled divisions from Abyssinia, where they had finished their fighting, from all over Asia, and from Palestine and Syria. They just grabbed the whole lot and willy-nilly hustled them into the desert to fill the gap. The South African division was second South African division was put up alongside us, and they were shrinking in panic at the thought of because their first division had been captured in Tobruk. They were that apologetic to think that one of theirs had surrendered, that one of them told me that I remove my South African flashes whenever I go on leave. I'm ashamed to be seen in it. They blamed their general Dan Pienaar for that Tobruk attack. He was partly at fault, but not completely. And they were ashamed to be seen. So they had a South African division, an Indian division, an Australian division, a New Zealand division, a mixed African, black African come white officers division, and a couple of British divisions. And then, I suppose, about 800 guns. And that was the big point, plus a narrow front to hold. So they were able to stop him then, and Auchinleck believed that the correct approach was to use attack, which is as defence, which had been proven before. So he used the 9th Division to make a series of attacks to try and take the few small hills, which were, of course, observation points. And if we reckoned if we could get him on the upset enough, he would withdraw.
So when did you actually get there?
Our battalion arrived, I think, on the 15th or something of July, 42. We were in reserve. The other two brigades were thrust forward, and two battalions. We were the senior battalion of our brigade. We were left in reserve near Amaria, out of Alexandria, for about 4 days, and then they said, move up. So we did. And there we found that they'd sent in our other two battalions. One of them they'd sent in a platoon to do a job that was not big enough to do, so it got wiped out.
What was that?
I think to make an attack on a strong point, a German strong point. And they thought that a platoon was sufficient, and it was apparently not enough. So they lost a platoon. So then they used the next battalion and sent in a company to do what needed a battalion. And the company got badly battered. So then they brought us up, and they sent us in as a battalion to do the job. On the first occasion, we did, but there was confusion and very bad planning as to the objective. We took our objective, and then with a lot of tanks, we lost 20-odd tanks in the process. Phil Lochman's one riding on tanks. A full company rode on the back of British tanks, and I found myself in the middle of a tank battle with our tanks behind, German tanks ahead, firing over our head, and every one of those shells was whizzing. I'm sure it was 2 inches over my helmet, but you know, that's the way it felt when you hear the crack of a anti-tank shell at low level firing at each other. The infantry on the ground feel like ants being trodden on.
What was it like in that situation?
Rather unpleasant. I was scared stiff, and I'm sure I was not alone. I remember ripping off my anti-tank respirator, a gas respirator, because that kept me off the ground another 6 inches with these shells just overhead, and I chucked it away and I never saw it again. And then after that tank battle, I don't know quite how we got out of it. I think we were ordered to withdraw, that's right, which we did do, to fall back on the hill. They said, you've gone too far. In fact, we hadn't.
What caused confusion?
One of the things is that in the desert there are a series of small hillocks 20 feet high which look alike, rocky hillock, and how far you go at night, how do you tell? And even by day it's hard to tell. And we had attacked and taken one hill, and it wasn't the next one. And there's dispute between two of those in charge as to what was the right spot, and they certainly didn't know. So we fell back on the hill, which we were told to do. But of course then they said, you still haven't taken Ruin Ridge, the one we want you to take, Mitteraya or Ruin Ridge. So you've got to do it again. They told us that a day or two later. Meantime, we were dug in on our first objective. We'd made a couple of 1,000 yards. And we were under 88mm airburst fire. And that is faster than the speed of sound. So what he did was to fire two or three shots at irregular intervals. And the first intimation you get is that they burst over your head. And after that, you hear the shot fired. But in the meantime, of course, we lost 50 casualties because people couldn't, you can't move about. You've got to move somewhere, otherwise you live in your trench day and night. So he would wait until they believed there would be a number walking about and fire two or three shots.